This is the April 16 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, Jim McCormick from AgMarket.net in McHenry, Illinois, and Brian Stark of the Andersons from right here in Champaign County. Our special guest for the day is the Senior Vice President for International Affairs at the North American Meat Institute, Bill Westman. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to us on demand anytime you'd like. You can do that at WILLAG.org. And while you're there, you'll find the webinar series that the Farm Doc team has been producing for the last couple of weeks. It's archived at WILLAG.org. You can see the upcoming events if you'd like to join us on one of those webinars. They're usually at 11 a.m. Central Time on Tuesday and Fridays. And you can also register for the event there. That's all at WILLAG.org. Let's start with a list of items that each of you would like to discuss for the day. Kurt Kimmel, what's on your agenda?
Well, a lot of guys are kind of interested in maybe how low's low or what type of time windows to maybe see some stability or some returns, some normalcy. And also, too, the question, or have you ever seen anything like this in the past? And we have, but not this severe.
Jim McCormick, how about you from AgMarket.net?
You know, Todd, I guess I'm going to talk about the ethanol industry per se and what this dynamic may mean for our industry in the long run and what we may have to do to make adjustments for this supply demand tables.
Brian Stark of the Andersons.
I think the biggest issue is when we're going to start to see some better demand prospects moving forward. And to Kurt's point, how low is low, and what's the producer to do with the old crop that he's still got left to market?
And Bill Westman from the North American Meat Institute.
Well, our members account for about 95% of red meat production in the U.S. and 70% of turkey. And so, obviously, we're watching very closely and concerned about production in our plants, distribution, and getting products to consumers.
Let's start with you. You mentioned that you represent a large cross-section of the meat processing industry. Can you tell me a little bit about that and what the North American Meat Institute does?
Well, in representing meat packers, as I mentioned, we handle both beef, pork, lamb, and turkey because several of our members account for a large percent of turkey production in the United States. So in representing them, I'm in charge of the international affairs area, and we are responsible for working closely with the U.S. Trade Representative, USDA, the Congress, and so forth, in terms of market access for our products around the world. And we're actively involved in advising on the trade negotiations, wherever they may be.
I believe you do have some experience working on trade issues on the international front. You have about three decades of experience with the FAS from USDA, Foreign Ag Service. How long were you in Beijing?
I was in Beijing from the mid-2007 to the beginning of 2010.
And you also were in Brazil?
I was in Brazil for about 5 years in the early 2000s and had other tours in Germany, Venezuela, Panama, and Dominican Republic.
That broad experience tells you what about the demand for red meat across the planet?
Well, in every location, every post I served at, the United States has an excellent reputation for high quality, for food safety, and we worked very hard to ensure that we took advantage of opportunities in those markets to export whatever product was in demand. And so all markets are somewhat different, so we had to adjust marketing strategies and ideas depending on the market. But it certainly was, in every place I worked on meat and poultry issues, and it was, everyone looks up to us in terms of the food safety and quality of our products. So that was probably the more fun part of the job, was to be able to promote U.S. red meat and poultry.
My experience as a reporter tells me that phytosanitary issues have been one of the bigger issues for red meat. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. We run our businesses, our companies run our business based on science and international standards, using the OIE and other organizations to gauge and operate our trading regime. And that's not always the case with our trading partners, particularly the European Union, which tends to base their decision-making on the precautionary principle, and that makes it very difficult to do business with countries like that.
Brian Stark of the Andersons, do you have a question?
Yeah, do you get a sense, given your experience with international trade, that China sooner or later will come back to the U.S., with the COVID-19 issues, and we'll start seeing maybe a little more better bean export numbers to them soon?
Yes, I do. I think there's tremendous opportunities for us there. We have tough competition in that market, as you know, for red meats from Australia, New Zealand, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, as well as pork coming out of the European Union and other countries. So it's not as if we're the only player in the market. So we face that competition. And when you have that level of competition, anytime you have artificial barriers to trade or high tariffs, you're at a significant disadvantage. And this is what we have faced recently. So I think if the market normalizes a little bit and we continue to get some tariff relief on a case-by-case basis, it's going to improve. But certainly the demand is tremendous, and we have a great opportunity there to expand our trade with China in the meat and poultry products.
Jim McCormick of AgMarket.net, a question from you.
One question, I guess. Have you talked to anybody about, the trying to control the risk of this virus in all these packing houses here in the United States? What is that industry as a whole saying right now about that, or how quick can they kind of get back to where they're more at full capacity?
Well, our members that have faced this problem are working very hard, working very closely with the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, as well as state and local health officials to mitigate this problem and to take care of our employees and make sure we keep our plants running. So we're working very, very hard on it. It's something, as you know, not just in food business, but all around the United States, we're faced with these outbreaks. But we're addressing it very aggressively. And we intend to ensure the safety of our employees and ensure that we're continuing to produce meat as much as we can to meet demand here and overseas.
Kirk Kimmel from Bates Commodities.
I just want to follow up a little bit. Brian touched on China. That's been the main focus, as everyone well knows. Is there some other countries that's on the back burner here for some potentially larger export business for the meat industry?
Well, I think that we have a tremendous trading relationship with North Asia in Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. Korea has been an excellent example of what happens when you have a trade agreement in place that reduces trade barriers. Korea is now our second largest market for beef exports. So we look to continue to expand there. The trade deal with Japan will help us expand the number of products we're able to sell. And I think that's a key point on China, too, which I didn't mention, is that the Phase 1 agreement will give us some additional opportunities for new products. And so we're looking forward to that. We work closely with the trade negotiators, and we're looking to see what we can do with the United Kingdom and the EU. And we know that the government is starting to look at negotiations with Kenya, which would serve as a model for African countries. And I should also mention that our membership also includes the companies that build and supply meat processing plants. So we see a significant opportunity in working with other countries to enhance their food safety systems, to improve operation in the plant, to improve cold chain development so that we can bring safe products to consumers, whether it's wholesale or retail level. So we're looking at it from several different angles, but there's a lot of opportunity out there in terms of the trade agreements coming forward.
In that last case, would it be the idea that animals on the hook would be processed on site in other countries?
Well, we see it as a twofold opportunity. It's been shown that when countries improve their food safety systems, when they improve the quality of products available to consumers, it does provide opportunities for us. It provides an opportunity for us to export our quality products to them. They become familiar with that type of product and packaging and distribution and cold chain, and it just opens it up very well for our members.
When you talk to the membership, what kinds of concerns did they have coming into the coronavirus and COVID-19, and what has developed that are the issues they believe they need to deal with? Now, I know they've been concerned about the workforce and labor. Are there other issues?
Well, I think that labor, as you mentioned, very important. I think that for us, it's supply chain and distribution, watching closely what happens with the trucking industry, because that's a key component of whether we're delivering livestock to the plants or we're moving product out of the plants to the greater market. So that is a concern. And working hard with the trucking industry, transportation industry, to ensure that that chain of distribution continues. From what we've seen, the supply chain is working. We do have some issues with individual plants, as you know, but the supply chain is strong and our meat production is strong. So we're working closely to ensure our employees are as safe as they can be and that the products coming out are safe. And as we know, products themselves cannot carry this virus, but consumers are doing the right thing and being vigilant and in terms of purchasing products and having products delivered to home. So we're hoping that it all comes together in the end.
On the supply chain issue, you got any resolutions or any way to solve this toilet paper issue we have?
I think everyone's faced with the same challenges there. As you are commodity guys, so you would probably understand this. I'm sure you understand that that's a high volume and low margin product. And so, as I understand it, the chains will keep just enough on hand to move it through, and they relied on regular weekly shipments in order to maintain that supply. When you have the drawdown and the hoarding of the toilet paper, then that disrupts that whole supply chain. So I'm sure they're working hard to trying to catch up.
Yeah, and my understanding, and this can come back to an agricultural issue, I think, is that part of the problem there is not the availability of toilet paper. It's the availability of toilet paper in the right packaging so that, and I think the bulk of the toilet paper is used by commercial sides. So it's just the wrong size rolls and that they're not available to ship in for consumers to use, which brings me kind of back to the boxed area and plants, for instance, that are servicing the Chinese markets. I think, and maybe Mr. Westman, you can help me out, that a lot of that is now going not in cuts, but in larger sizes. So half a beef or half an animal. Is that right? And what kinds of issues have you had to deal with in the past? And are there issues in the plants and the shipment of that are related to coronavirus? And maybe that's not the case, but you can help me out.
Well, I don't think it's the case, but we're shipping all different types of products to China, depending on the market. A couple of years ago, when the market started to open up, we were actually shipping case-ready product to Shanghai, that went right into the e-commerce market, and we were delivering directly to businesses and homes. So that's changed a little bit. When we were faced with the tariff situation, that business dried up. Now it's starting to come back a little bit, but we're seeing a demand and interest in buying six carcasses cut in sixths and wrapped so that they can do some processing on that end. That's one alternative. If we can get these relief on the tariffs, then we see a great opportunity for high quality beef going into China. Certainly the demand is there. When I was there, I was told, we work closely with food service and other industries, they said, we will buy whatever you have. The demand is so strong. And I think that, unfortunately, because of the decimation of the swine herd in China because of African swine fever, has only multiplied this demand many, many times. I mean, they are protein deficit, and they're doing their best to purchase whatever they can. I think our immediate issues in the last month has been the availability of reefers, of refrigerated containers. When things took off on COVID in China, there was a stoppage at the ports. They didn't have enough workers to load and unload containers. And so this created a supply chain issue for us. And that, I think, is only just starting to get better. You had what's called the pendulum swing in container availability, where we didn't have any containers coming in. We had product backing up in the ports. And then all of a sudden, you have a rush of containers coming in, and you need to be able to process those shipments and get them out. So it's created a lot of challenges for everyone. We're in a very unusual situation, as everyone knows, that we're trying to deal with. So the side effect of COVID is this strain on transportation and being able to service the market. But certainly, we're poised. The new Phase 1 agreement with China will give us tremendous opportunities, and we're just looking forward to when we can get back to the business of selling meat. So I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, and one final question from me before we transition to the rest of the folks here. Does the North American Meat Institute have a good handle on what the decline in the size of the herd in China was, the pig herd, that is, from ASF?
Well, when I was there, we spent much of our time trying to verify Chinese data, production data, regardless of the commodity or product. So that's the challenge, is to get good numbers out of China and trying to verify that. I think that the estimates I've seen and the studies we've looked at, you're looking at about a 40% reduction in the sow herd, which probably commodity experts would know this. That's larger than our domestic swine herd. So you lose that level of production, it has an impact worldwide. So, you know, that's why we were trying to verify some of these numbers, but it's just, as you know, difficult to do that out of China.
Jim McCormick from AgMarket.net. You put the ethanol industry on your list of discussion points for the day. It has suffered greatly as the number of miles driven in the United States dropped dramatically with people staying home and sheltering in place. How much of a problem is it for the corn market? And is there a solution going forward?
Well, right now, Todd, yeah. I mean, you saw what the USDA did in this last report. They essentially cut ethanol, corn consumption from ethanol, down by about 375 million bushels. The fact of the matter is, when you look at how less we are driving right now, that's probably not enough, unfortunately. You're probably looking closer, we believe, to at least 600 million drop in demand for corn for ethanol, probably as much as 800. And my biggest fear is, I know a lot of people, Todd, are out there thinking we're going to snap back and we're going to get this economy going back really, really fast. But my biggest fear for the ethanol industry is, I think we've changed the way a lot of people do work. A lot of people who used to commute to Chicago are now staying at home. A lot of call centers that were driving to Chicago, they're now staying at home. They've spent tons of millions of dollars equipping these people to work from home with computers and modems. There's a very good shot some of those people do not come back and start working at corporate centers, and they work from home from here on out. So the question I have for this ethanol industry that I'm worried about for our ag sector right this moment is, how do you get this consumption of ethanol back up? So if you're not driving, you're not consuming. So we're probably going to have to see some of a policy change from our government, either, you know, essentially increasing the blend or doing something right now, because fact of the matter is we are overproducing a product for energy that we're just not going to need in the near term, it looks like. So we've got to come up with a solution. And like I said, I would suggest that you got to increase that blend, although politically that's going to be very tough to do.
On the politics side, Brian Stark, at least five states, four for sure, have requested that the Trump administration not go ahead and enforce the RFS, which would require 15 billion gallons of ethanol to be used in the U.S. at some point, whether it goes into the gasoline supply, which it can't, at least not at 10%, because there's just not enough miles driven. How much of a problem does that create? And do you think the Trump administration will side with oil or corn on this one?
I think that's a great question, Todd. You're right. There's been five states, Texas, Wyoming, Utah, Oklahoma, and Louisiana, that have asked for nationwide waivers against RFS blending mandate. I think President Trump's going to have a tough decision to make, because it's not surprising with the less miles driven that the concern of some of these mandated refiners to blend ethanol are going to struggle to meet that blend and what they do. It spills over into the RINs market, and although I'm certainly not expert on the RINs or the ethanol market in itself, obviously that's the only way to solve getting you up to the regulated mandate when you can't physically blend the ethanol. So, yeah, it's a good question, because there's a lot of pressure he had with the small waivers when the judgment was handed down that they were not able to be passed through. He did not appeal, so he sided with the ethanol business of things. Will he continue to side that direction in an election year? I think this becomes a political issue, and I think it's yet to be determined. But I think the biggest thing is that the market itself has really done its job pulling gallons offline. The problem is that we're running in, even with the reduced rate, run into storage crunches. You're seeing this with oil. Now you're seeing it with ethanol, where are you going to put this stuff? How long will it keep? Those sorts of things, until we actually get back to driving and be able to use it. And I'm with Jim. I think it's going to take a while to actually get not just the demand for corn back, but also to work through some of the glut of supply that we have. It's a storage problem. And I think that's the markets, you know, is part of the reason why everything from an S&D standpoint, from a demand drop to a macro influence, has allowed this market to continue to grind lower than anybody's expected. And trying to figure out where the bottom is has been like trying to catch a falling knife. And I think really what you need to see happen is for some demand, whether that be feed demand, export demand, start to develop to counteract all this bearish influence. And unfortunately, when we've tried to see the livestock industry as a big bright star, when the other two components of corn demand have really taken a hit, and now you see meat packers struggling with COVID, it causes great concern. There's no doubt.
Okay, so I want to stick with you for just a second and make sure I have this right. So under the RFS, gasoline, there's a blend wall at 10%. Generally speaking, we don't drive enough miles to get to 15 billion gallons of ethanol, meaning we don't, that's not equal to 10%. It's greater than 10% of the number of miles or gallons used to drive the miles we're doing at this point. And you're telling me that there's a storage issue, and the way we normally get around, say, the 1.5 or 500 million gallons, depending on what year it is, of extra ethanol that needs to be used by mandate, relatively speaking, is that the RINs market is used for gallons that are already produced but are in storage. And so those RINs prices are related to some extent to the available storage. They have now tripled, if I remember correctly. And I think what you're telling me is that everything's going to be full up, and so not even the RINs will be able to solve the problem. Is that right?
I mean, that would be one man's opinion. I think today you have not cut production or slowed it down enough. We've done a great job here in the last couple of weeks, but not enough to slow the build into storage. And so at some point, the market has to force more gallons offline.
Very simply, Brian was saying, we're going to literally run out of storage. Right now, if they stop producing ethanol today, it'd take 91 days to get rid of the supply we have. We're more of a just-in-time production, so we are literally going to run out of space to put it. That's the problem you've got at this point. And then once those ethanol plants go down, and you take that process of shutting it back down, I don't see them coming back online to the fall at the earliest. And it just becomes a cycle. Is what do you do with all this old crop corn that's been unpriced? That was a lot of farmers thought were going to be selling it to the ethanol plants this summer during the driving season. Now they have no place to go with it. And it's a very scary thought. Did you see, Todd, the CME groups actually talking about negative price crude oil options? Theoretically, trading options at a negative value. In essence, you're paying somebody to take the product. They're actually talking about that to CME group, which is amazing when you think about it and kind of scary in the big picture.
Kirk Kimmel, you want to weigh in?
No, I saw that too this morning, Jim. Yeah, when you start having to pay to get out of a position, everybody's comfortable. Go to zero and that's it. But
well, think about that, Kirk. I mean, even for the housing market. I mean, so a commodity used to be able to think, well, I can't lose more than what I paid for it. In theory, the CME is going, you could actually lose more than what you paid for it.
There's definitely somebody wanting to go negative to promote that idea.
Well, I was just thinking about the storage and the RINs and the waivers, thinking that this would clearly be a way that the waivers could be put in place. There would be so much ethanol in space that you simply couldn't, if there's not storage at the ethanol plants because they just don't have the storage. The refineries apparently don't have the storage, or they've filled them up for the most part, and there just isn't a place to go. The RINs then, in that case, can't be used because they're supposed to be on gallons that are pre-produced, so there's no way to do it unless you provide a waiver. It's a tough political football for agriculture and the oil industry together, and the Trump administration will have to work its way through it. So, given all of that, what a bad news day. How low is low, Kurt Kimmel? You're the one who asked that question.
I'm beginning to wonder myself now. It's a concern, yes. When this all first started, there was some talk of 275 corn, and, you know, there's some cash corn there's corn out there below $3 here in the East in some cases, but that's a concern managing downside risk. Short term and through here, we've been looking at some lows trying to be established as we go into the deliveries. Deliveries are just, around the corner and through here. Guys have been throwing in the towel on some of these basis contracts, so hopefully we can see some stability here and have some type of dead cat balance as we go into May. But the key longer term is if we don't have some type of weather concern here as we move forward, this thing can drift, and it can drift for quite some time. So the key is to try to manage some downside price risk and stay flexible and have some staying power. That's the whole key here as we move forward.
Brian Stark, as an elevator manager, your job is to run as many bushels through the elevator as you possibly can, for the margin, correct?
Yep.
And I'm wondering what issues you're having to deal with trying to manage your way through this process.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a challenge for us today like the producers facing, but I would say to what we've described, talking about overall corn demand, when Jim mentions that you have all this old crop that normally goes to ethanol, and ethanol may or may not be there until new crop, now you've got this excess supply that has to go somewhere. And traditionally, you would see an increase in volume at the commercial elevator assets. And I think that that's a likely spot with less processors in the market. But yet again, for us as a commercial facility, you have to look at where is our demand points. Well, if ethanol is not there, then you have to look at the feed sector, or you have to look at the export market. Those both are challenging, to say the least, at the current state right now. Now, we'd like to believe that there's going to be some export business middle to late summer, improving prospects. as we get through some of these short-term challenges and phase one considerations by China start to look at, you know, Brazil and Argentina as an example, not to switch commodities, but they've been exporting at a record pace on soybeans. And in my opinion, I don't think they can maintain that pace all summer long. I think someone said they could, Brazil could export 14 million metric ton in the month of April of beans. I don't think that pace can be sustained. And so at some point in time, you get some business back. But when you think about the producer and for us specifically as well, the marketing opportunities, I think you're going to be kicking the can down the road till July or August. And by then, you're going to have the weight of a potential normal to above normal crop as a potential outcome. Not saying that that will happen, but that's something that's an overhead today. At least today, the producer has a revenue trigger on his price component for insurance at 330 December futures. He's got, if he took PLC, he's got 370 type floor. So he's protected on his new crop bushels, but there really is no floor for old crop. And I think so, given the fact that I believe demand is going to be hard to come by until later this summer, I think any type of rally, the producer needs to realize that they have to start scaling up selling their remaining old crop position.
Do you see grain elevators building outside piles again with old crop corn?
Well, I think it's a distinct possibility depending on what the economics of the market tell us. I mean, if you just think about what Jim said, if you cut another, what do we do, 375, and he said could be 600, could be 800 million total off corn, you're talking about an old crop carryout that could approach, quick math in my head, another 400 million, so 2.5 billion, and then you plant 97 million, or even let's just say we see switching and we go to 94 million, and you have a trend line yield. You're talking about a 3.5 billion bushel carryout projected, and now all of a sudden you've got really wide basis, you got really wide carry, and so in that instance, yeah, there's lack of demand, so there's going to be more supply, and we could be dealing with a storage crunch here down the road, just like we're talking about the energy sector right now.
Building on Brian was saying, very simply, we think they're going to cut the ethanol. We think they do. We could bump up the feed usage a little bit as we feed less distillers greens. We'll feed more corn, but we're working like an ending stock number somewhere around 2.2, 2.25. Okay, but if you take that ending stock number and then we do plant 97 million acres of corn and we have a trend yield, your total supply theoretically going into fall of this year would be 18 billion bushels of corn. That's a billion more than we've ever, billion and a half more than we ever had on hand before. So I think as we start getting into this, if we get confirmation that we do, that we did plant that many acres, storage is going to be a massive issue this fall, plain and simple.
Kirk Kimmel, I think this is the place that will ask you, is there anything like this in the past?
It reminds me quite a bit of the early 80s, except then we had record high or real high interest rates versus 0% interest rates now. Back then, we built some inventory. We had a lot of CCC stocks around. And corn carryout was 4 billion bushel. Stocks ratio was 50%. Even beans and wheat was 50 to 75%. Just massive supplies. There was no hope whatsoever. And the sad part is we lost a good portion of the farming community just due to the higher interest rates and couldn't make payments and so forth. So it was terrible. And feels like that type of atmosphere again. We're going to have to go through some pain. And over time, the market was low enough and the demand started to be stimulated. But what helped the market come up out of that hole was basically the 88 drought. So it's going to take some type of weather phenomena here to lower the supply if we go ahead and have the extra acres in the ground. And the count on a weather event happening is kind of a long shot in through here, but it's going to have to be something like that. Otherwise, we could probably grind lower here for quite some time.
Bill Westman, you've been listening to this conversation. Do you have anything to add?
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, as a side impact of the problem with ethanol and lack of storage and some plants going down is the lack of carbon dioxide production, which is a byproduct of the process, and that's affecting us. It's affecting, I think, the entire food production sector. So that's something that we're looking at and concerned with. To me, the only outlet there perhaps is exports, and we know that ethanol is included in the Phase 1 agreement with China. So we're hoping that that will come to pass, that will provide some relief to the storage capacity problem that we have.
I'm not familiar with this, but carbon dioxide is a byproduct of ethanol production, I take it.
Yes. It's used in our plants. It's used in other food production facilities as well. And so it's becoming an issue, yes.
You just don't have a supply of it because ethanol plants are shutting down.
That's right.
Oh.
Yes.
And
correct.
It's used in what part of the process?
So we can, as you know, as alluded to, you could, force plants to produce ethanol. Well, what are you going to do with it? There's no place to store it. And so we're looking at other alternatives. Where can we get carbon dioxide from other industries, other sectors, if there's this, this slowdown, stoppage, if you will, in ethanol? So it is a concern, and it's something we're working with the government on to try to resolve.
Do you have questions you want to ask the commodity analyst?
No, I think it's fascinating to see that we're all facing storage issues and backups in the market. And unfortunately, as I feel with as Brian Jimmer Kurt mentioned, this unprecedented times and relives some of the things we faced a long time ago. So we're resilient, though. We're going to keep working and working with you and do the best we can to get by this.
We haven't talked much about soybeans at this point. Brian Starks mentioned them at least once. Jim McCormick from the soybean side of the ledger, fewer acres, seems to have better fundamentals.
It does. I think they got a little bit better fundamental situation. I think like right now the market's struggling right now because we're just not getting that demand from China like a lot of people thought. I know today I think there was a headline story that China had bought some beans from Brazil. I believe it was for August, September delivery. And, I think it's just very disappointing, I think, to the bean market. They really thought China would be starting to ramp up those U.S. purchases. We haven't seen them yet. I do believe that will come, but part of it's just the currency. The currencies are killing us. This higher dollar versus the lower real that we're seeing is keeping us at the more expensive end of the range, and that becomes a problem. I mean, I will tell you, Todd, on these beans, I was actually leaning to think maybe we'd pick up more bean acres and less corn acres just due to this economic rout we've had in the last couple of weeks. I was talking to one of our partners today, and he was saying some of the people you've talked to in the fertilizer industry said they are pushing a lot of fertilizer out here in Illinois, and right now they are not seeing much of a shift from corn to beans. The guys are locked in corn, and they're going to plant corn, it seems like, in Illinois. At least that's what we're seeing today from the fertilizer guys. So that did surprise me a little bit.
Yeah, some, I think, had thought because the bean planters were running prior to the cold weather that was an indication there might be more bean acres. I think it's simply an indication that farmers believe and have been told that beans can tolerate cold weather better than corn, and they wanted to plant something given their experience from last year. Kurt Kimmel, anything on the bean market from you?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, there's some demand coming here as we get more than the traditional time window as far as Chinese. Right now, the boats are moving out of the southern hemisphere, but the supply-demand balance sheet much tighter as you look forward. Meal demand, if you're in the spec leaf side of the equation, you might want to take a look at purchasing some meal here near this week's lows and risk $2 or $3. Meal demand continues to be strong. Crush, another phenomenal crush number, 181 million bushels versus expectations of 175 million bushels. So a lot of protein out there. As far as backing some of this livestock up, some of these guys are tweaking the rations a little bit to slow down the rate of gain. And it'll be interesting to see how the cold storage reports unfold here, but more importantly, the cattle and feed reports, see how these placements take place here over the next month or two.
And finally, I think I'll end, Bill Westman, with a question for you. I suspect the industry's been thinking about this. As animals are fed to heavier weights, and more importantly, as they're trying to figure out what to do with their availability to put animals in crates or on pasture, wherever that happens to be, they can't bring new animals into the system. Is that an issue that the meat market is trying to work through or think about yet?
Well, certainly it's something that we're thinking about when you have plants in South Dakota or Greeley or Iowa, Nebraska, that temporarily close. There is, in my opinion, a dramatic impact on local livestock producers. I think was alluded to was that this perhaps reduction in feed use to slow weight gain, I think is already occurring. And, we're in a situation where you may need to think about how do we move this livestock to facilities that might be able to process them in a timely manner. So it's something that's, this has come up in the last week, and this is something that we're looking at. So you're correct. I mean, this is an issue going forward that we're watching very closely.
Let's get a final word now from each of you. Kurt Kimmel from Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. I'll start with you today.
Yeah, there's a lot of moving parts here, but there is some downside risk. And for those who are looking at kind of wanting to manage that, these $3 December corn puts don't look too bad if this thing doesn't straighten out.
Jim McCormick of AgMarket.net out of McHenry, Illinois. Your final word?
My final word is, I like I said, I'm definitely a little bit leery about what's going to happen over the next couple of weeks. I think this May WASDE report is going to look really ugly when they print the 97 million planted acres with their trend yield. What we're recommending guys do is consider using the short-dated options. You can buy like a June 325 short-dated put for around 10 cents. That won't lock you into that price in case you happen to get a surprise move, but it will put some protection under these bushels that producers have that unfortunately got caught and have not marketed an old crop.
Brian Stark from the Andersons from right here in Champaign County.
I'll just reiterate what I talked about earlier, Todd, and say that the producer really needs to think about his old crop that's remaining unpriced, given all the bearish dynamic on the demand side today, and really look to sell and reward rallies liquidate the risk that he really doesn't have a lot of downside protection on it today moving forward.
And you'd want to do that before the WASDE on May 12?
I would say that would be a good place to do it if you get a little bit of a pop to do a little more old crop pricing prior to that report.
And finally, Bill Westman of the North American Meat Institute out of Washington, D.C. Any final word from you?
Yes, thank you. Just to reassure folks that our companies are working hard to supply also meat and poultry products to the entire country. Certainly, the medical community is first in line in terms of their priority, but second in line probably are everyone involved in the food business and getting food to our consumers. So we're working hard to ensure we're a major part of that solution. So thank you for having me.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may find and listen to the whole of our program anytime you'd like on demand. You can do that at WILLAG.org. That's willag.org. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Kurt Kimmel, Jim McCormick, Brian Stark, and Bill Westman. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.